Welcome to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. We travel to or invite the movers and shakers of the mobility, energy, and climate ecosystem. Listen in and enjoy the talks.
I am proud and excited today to welcome Venkatesh Gopal from MoveMe. Hi, Venkatesh.
Hi, Christian. Thanks. And thanks for having me. Glad. Yeah, pleasure is all mine.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for contributing. I'm particularly proud as I have the pleasure to talk to a seasoned veteran of our ecosystem and our industry. Well, I mean, I've come across your past several times in the last couple of years. Honestly, I mean, without too much of an exaggeration, I think this is mutual. But I think we've seen a lot. And this is what makes me proud, because you, Venkatesh, and MoveMe, you have inspired, consulted, and developed so many of the shared mobility players out there that, I truly see your activities as a cornerstone to this ecosystem and this industry. And I'm convinced that it would look differently today if you would not exist. So that's something special. And that's what I do appreciate. But without talking too much about you, I would like to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and also the activities of MoveMe, and the audience can learn a little bit about that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, very generous and very kind. I will say one thing, that I stand as one of the inspired ones. So yeah, more than the inspiring, I would say, and I fall on the inspired ones. The industry and everybody that's part of the industry, it has been contributing over the last so many years. I, over the last, 6 years now, have been working full-time as shared mobility consultant in this space. This has always been one of the prime attractive, spaces that I wanted to work. And I'm glad that I do. So yeah, it's pleasure is all mine to join you in this conversation. Thank you so much, Christian, for the invitation. I am Venkatesh Gopal from MoveMe. At MoveMe, we are a small team out of Vancouver, Canada, and we are shared mobility consultants. And in terms of our consulting practice, we do work with clients all across the world. So we've been fortunate to working with Canadian companies, American companies, European companies. And that's one of the reasons why, and also fortunately, because remote work and everything else works so seamlessly well nowadays, we have associates placed in Europe who work and help us with the projects that are in Europe. We call them practice leads, and they help us deliver projects to our clients. As MoveMe, we design, plan, and grow shared mobility services, car share, bike share, scooter share, on-demand transit, mobility as a service, or multimodal integrated transportation, you name it. I believe we have a unique strength in putting together operational realities with the need for regulatory policies. So I think we need the regulatory policies, but at the same time, all services need to be practically possible to happen, such that the shared transportation ecosystem is designed for the community. That's why we need the regulations, and designed to sustain itself. And I know it's, Christian, you and I have talked about this so many times, and almost every time we speak about shared mobility, we speak about like profitability and sustainability by itself and what makes sense and how can that be, you know, more practical in terms of implementation. And that's where it opens the doors to sustainable mode shift. I advise organizations on private and public. I advise private and public organizations on feasibility and electrification of shared mobility services. I have a business background and having worked with clients, and I think as of now, out of the 87 projects that MoveMe has done, I may have worked with about 37, 38 of them. And I've tried to like fit my knowledge from into practice and helping cities and operators from like the business and viability side of things personally. And I'm glad that I sought out the shared mobility space a few years back and wished to build a career in it. And I couldn't be more excited to be working alongside all the experts, including Nectar and Christian and the team in the shared mobility space.
Wonderful, Venkatesh. Thanks for providing that first overview. What would be the typical kind of client to approach you, and what phase of development or maturity would they be would this be an idea stage? Or, I mean, maybe you can just talk about, let's say, this kind of ideal customer and the journey they should experience.
Yes. So as consultants, we do work with a variety of clients. So in the beginning, over the last 10 years, we worked with multiple different stages of clients, and also shared mobility in the last 10 years has changed dramatically, right? You or everybody else could know this. And in that sense, early on with MoveMe, we used to work with a lot of like operators and ideas of like launching an idea, promoting an idea, working towards like, okay, does it fit? Is car share for the city kind of a thing? And that's where, and technology, right? So everybody had to find what kind of technology they could use, what would be ideal for them to like launch a car sharing service or a bike sharing service. Everything was fairly new and people were exploring. So that was the time back then. But I think over the years, now the industry has graduated. And in that sense, our clientele now is thankfully across public, private, and technology providers. I name technology providers as separately because they are not operating services themselves, but they definitely could be working with public or private organization, depends on what technology providers you are. And our work with the public clients is basically on public policy recommendations and strategy of shared mobility. So, and public agencies are equally concerned about viability, right? So they are also concerned about how much would this cost us as a city or a province to fund something like a bike share scheme or a car share scheme. Should we be funding this? Yes. And if they buy, how much would it be? And the second one is like, how long do we have to keep funding this, right? So they are also looking at how sustainable the whole system could be on its own, and everybody wants it. And this is where I feel the industry has matured to understand that everything, all the business has to keep running by itself, right? So as much as we love public transit and public transportation, we know that shared mobility cannot fall into the same category of, you know, funding and requirements and challenges that the public transportation faces. So in our projects, mostly our focus is about, you know, helping private organizations and public organizations in terms of like how you could improve your service levels, how you could improve your behavioral change and mode shift goals, and eventually how the system or the services can reliably stick around. Because in a nutshell, reliability is the only thing that clicks in this industry. Mm-hmm. If it's not, then the public agencies can't plan policy for long term, as well as the private organizations can't be sticking around for longer term.
You mentioned it before, you've witnessed various changes of direction and the industry, which direction it went, right? What would you say, what would you recognize as the major shifts of paradigm or mindset shifts, if you want, in this ecosystem that you witnessed in the last years? Like, what are the key ones for you that we like, oh my God, it's like, always take some time. I know this is not from one day to the other, but typically the aftermath, it's like looking back and saying, oh my God, this was okay. This was really a big shift.
From the technology provider's perspective, I think people have started realizing how technology can help, whether they need it or not, right? So in that sense, I think the maturity in terms of operations and even like data anonymizing and dashboards and collection, how technology can help. So people realize that the recognition of data is there, and there's definitely that aspect of how much do you need to measure? What's an overkill in terms of like gathering data, but at the same time, what you need to understand your operations or, you know, your services in your city. So that's one. People have woken up to like how they could use and understand and measure shared mobility services. The other paradigm shift is, if you wanted to call it, would be, and I would say in some of the operations side, it has been there for a long term. And we can see those services sticking around, which is profit before growth, right? So a lot in terms of shared mobility has always been, over the first half of the decade, I would say, was always about like grow. Just go and check how many cities you can do. So micro mobility providers would just like count the number of cities, car share providers would just go and flood the number of cities with the number of cars that they could. And then eventually people would find out that this model doesn't work in the same way as it did in the other city, right? And now you have a problem of like services going bust. You can't survive. The few users that started using a service in a city, now they can't use the service because they're not around. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the paradigm shift is in terms of like the profit before growth in terms of operations. And for the policy makers, there is a stop and think and proceed kind of an approach. So they are taking an informed approach towards what they want to do, what kind of systems they want. Do they even need a bike share system? Do they need a scooter share system to go along with the bike share system? Do they need a free floating one? Do they need a car share system? And I think that's where the cities are also evaluating how they can regulate them. But I think the next, if I may go up to like extending a little bit more, I think the next paradigm shift or the next quick change of mindset that needs to happen from the policymaker side is to not to over-regulate. Because, you know, now that you started to like understand how things work, it's not required for everything to be regulated and, you know, structured and constrained. Many of the behavioral change will happen when services are just allowed to stick around.
Yes, yes. And it's funny that you mentioned it because that's exactly that resembles basically my perception. And I see, I guess, more from a European perspective, because I've witnessed various services arrive, being launched, grow, die, etc. This kind of cycle, or succeed, right? And what I recognized a couple of years ago was that a lot of cities were totally unprepared to the advent of shared mobility, especially micro. And let's say, unfortunately, brackets, the micromobility sphere was fueled by so much capital. So they had to deploy a sheer mass of vehicles and assets out there, which cities were overwhelmed with. And I've seen a lot of cities like that, they felt completely out of control. Like they were like, oh my God, I what's happening there? I have no control over it. And especially in the European mindset of governmental organizations and public institutions, this is not a happy place.
Yeah.
As soon as you find a way to turn this around, to get back in control, you go that route, right? And that's what a little of the cities did. And now, resembling what you said, yes, a lot of cities are on the other end of the spectrum, not unprepared anymore, but out of that pressure they felt, maybe started to overregulate. Overregulate from their perspective, it's not overregulation. It's necessary, of course, right? Because you need to control. But I also would love to see the pendulum shift back into something that's more in the middle of things, to be able to give the services also a little bit more room and flexibility and wiggle room to breathe, to develop, to experiment. Because what often forgotten is that those models, those business models, are not set in stone, and a lot of them are not profitable per se. You have something in place that kind of works, and then you need to iteratively improve it to get closer and closer to profitability and maybe succeed at some point, right? But that experimentation requires wiggle room from a regulatory point of view. If it's so tight, like a corset, that you cannot even, how to say, experiment with different operational models, then it gets really, really, really tough. And then I do understand some operators taking the decision to actually leave markets because they say, well, these are not the framework conditions that enable us to build. Yeah. So that experience reflects very well. Yeah. Please go ahead.
I was going to ask you to inform some more aspects of this difference between like continents, right? So there is North America and there is Europe. I think you're rightly pulling out instances of how cities in Europe have had a head start in terms of sustainable mobility and shared mobility. And although the models that may be successful, the ridership, the membership demographics or whatnot may not be the same across continents, but there is definitely a similarity of what works and what doesn't. In what sense? Because cities are also different, people are different. In terms of like European, you've definitely seen overregulation, but you've also seen operators now realizing what works for them and what doesn't, right? So they don't necessarily need to, for example, everybody's talking about micromobility, let's just talk about like scooters because they are being banned in so many cities. But even it's not in the interest of the operators to litter cycles, right? So it's that's not the target. It's definitely the outcome, which they did not expect, or they did not care, depending on which operator we are talking about. But now, because thanks to regulation, many of that has come in control. And I feel, do you, and maybe you can inform us a little bit more, do you see that cities have regulated good well? And the operators are also getting into like, they know what works and what doesn't, and they're trying to self-regulate themselves, like not, and they know what works in terms of technology, right? So they can intervene and change behaviors. Do you see that? And the second thing is, how do you see that cities are looking at transportation? Do you see that the transportation is looked at from less from the infrastructure side in the European cities and more towards like, how can we work this towards mobility and change of behavior for people and less about like what we can build kind of thing?
Yes, let me address the first one first. And the second one, I might get back to that. But with regards to the regulation and the spectrum, right? Like lightly regulated or no regulations at all until super, super tight and rigid. I couldn't generalize necessarily and say one thing works better than, so something in the middle works better than something in the extreme. Why? I recognized that both can work as long as there is a mutual exchange and dialogue and conversation happening between the city and the service providers / mobility providers. I think this is what I saw as key drivers to successful collaboration, to successful and to a, let's say, happy setup where the city is happy, citizens are happy, and then also service providers are happy. And I saw this happening on the light regulated spectrum as well in the rigid one. But what is key there is it was a dialogue to create that together with a joint, let's say, goal in mind, and then also a negotiation process towards reaching that goal, which both sides also interest, also understand that the other side might have understandably different kind of interests, not opposing, but a different kind of goal setting within, right? But and that might look like a conflict of interest at first, but as long as when you talk about it, then you find, aha, what's behind that interest? Aha, can we work around that somehow? But that dialogue is so important. More so than the question of whether it's rigid or more a light regulatory framework in place. This is what I found key. And also to name the cases that didn't work out that well was when specifically cities decided to really talk in a top-down approach, just imply the rules and just take it or leave it, right? That was not very helpful, should be clear. So that answers your first question. I don't know if this was a kind of helpful.
No, I think it totally does. I feel you being in the technology side, you also realize this. If we did not conduct those mistakes, we wouldn't be at this point of like shaping, knowing what works and what doesn't, right? So it's always like that kind of a question of how much of innovation would one allow and what one wouldn't, because unless you do, you wouldn't know if it works. And if you're trying to solve a new problem, and climate change, sustainability and congestion is always going to be a new problem, because we wouldn't have so many people in our cities as we have today. Right? So tomorrow is always going to be a bigger number. So how are you going to tackle that demand? And things are going to be different. People are going to work in a different phase. You would get viruses. Hello. And in that sense, how would you test out what works for tomorrow, today, if you're not experimenting, and you have to let that go ahead and fail and experiment. And I think European cities are doing it a far better innovation-wise.
Interesting that you say that. Yeah, I mean, what I do recognize is I'm not an expert on that one, but I think the diversity of different approaches is interesting. I think there are completely different approaches, right, across the continent that you recognize and then you can witness. You can see this also as a, let's say, a test lab for different kind of approaches and then can learn from that. On the second one, I'm not sure whether I got the essence of your question. So it was transportation related and related to the change of behavior. But if you could try to rephrase it, then yes. I'm happy to tackle this one.
Yeah. So the conversation that I've had over with some of the other people in European context is we see a drive from the cities and the ministry side towards exploring like service viability and looking at transportation more from mobility side of things than transportation from building roads and building cycling infrastructure. Even, I mean, not just non-sustainable infrastructure, also like building bike lanes, building, you know, infrastructure for EVs and those kind of things. So there's definitely that. It's not that it's not happening, but do you think cities are moving towards like, we need to build certain things, yes, but also we need to like focus on mobility and managing mobility and regulating mobility a little bit more instead of just adding infrastructure and engineering our cities the way we did before?
Very good question. Let me reflect on it. So on the one hand side, I perceive cities, yes, also historically being very strong on the thinking infrastructure, right? Because it was the, let's say, purpose, identity, justification. And then, of course, there's the political dimension to it, where if the mayor can present this shiny new whatever has been built and just cut the rope, and those are the moments, right? This is also the currency for, let's say, the political landscape to live with. So this is, I think this is also a little bit towards reasoning why. Yes, I do see cities, on the other hand, also investing into creating those frameworks, both regulatory data from a data perspective and even a business model perspective, by trying to creating something like a platform where different parties can connect to, right? And where an interchange can happen in a curated manner and supported manner. I think there's a lot of will towards developing in this direction. It depending on who's participating, I think there's always something to learn from. And I highly appreciate any form of willingness to collaborate between the public and the private sector. So I'm a big fan of private public partnerships, for example, right? Because in my point of view, this is the way to go. It's not just the private sector. It's not just the public sector who's going to solve it. It's just a combination of the tools make it happen. I recently had an interview with another gentleman, one of the primary drivers for car sharing in Europe. And he said what they learned is that you need the most successful car sharing schemes were based in cities that already had a very good public infrastructure backbone. And this is not exclusively the recipe for success, yes, but I've also seen that. And kind of the complementary effect that comes into place. And this is for me another one more, let's say, points of evidence that it is thinking complementary, thinking about, okay, public infrastructure and systems can provide, let's say, the autobahn of the high bandwidth function within a city mobility, but there are always those small areas of gaps and stuff. And this is where you need complementary services that are highly efficient in that sense, can also fill that gaps, which public transport cannot. So enabling those two worlds to come closer together and enabling both worlds to also coexist is something that I think has to be the future. And one of the developments that fall in this category is deployment of autonomous vehicles, like you have now in Phoenix, in San Francisco, LA, Miami soon, right? Both from Waymo as well as the guys from Tesla. And there, what's interesting that I see happening is that there are cities who are proactively seeking collaboration with those companies and trying to build the frameworks to enable those kind of companies and robotaxi fleets to. Why? Because they see it as a strong economic factor for the future, and they see it as a potential competitive advantage also for the city in comparison and in competition to other cities and city ecosystems. So this is something that I recently discussed with a US-based mayor of one of the larger metropolis. I was amazed because this was a new concept to me. And he was like, yeah, of course. And if Tokyo makes a big announcement that now the Waymo fleet is coming, and yes, of course, there's a political will for that. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. We want to be at the same league. So it is interesting to see that kind of positive competition coming up, right? What is next level of shared mobility that's shaping right now?
We would rather have that for less like new shiny tech and more towards like, hey, they got, 80% more share into active transportation. Let's also get, 80%, rather than having, they got AV tech and we got AV tech. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's totally positive in terms of innovation. And we, like I said, it's something that we need to test it out and see what it works. There's definitely, and give it time for it to settle. But hopefully cities also start, competing on those statistics of who's making the cities better livable. I mean, definitely there's that part, because the more livable it is, the more attractive it is, and you attract businesses and people, but it's general.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Dave. What's your take on electrification? I ask you as many others, and the question comes from the observation that, generally speaking, electrification of vehicles and fleets and everything is like, it received a tailwind a couple of years ago, I felt, with the whole climate tech, like ecosystem growing, a lot of capital going into that, Green Deal in Europe or something very, very similar happening in the US. Now I feel it's more like a headwind. What's your take?
Interesting that you say that. And this is one of the years that we, not in terms of like shared mobility, but I would say in general, people have started like raising an eyebrow in Canada about EVs and the rebates being taken off. So to give you this brief, EV rebates were available until the last year for passenger vehicles, for small businesses, fleets, as well as individuals. And this year, because of budget constraints, the federal government has taken off. Now, in all fairness, we all knew that rebates are not going to be permanent, right? So we knew that, okay, when it started in 2019 or whenever it was, in 5, 6 years, 7 years, this is, rebates are definitely not going to be permanent. They're going to be taken off. But whenever they did, there was like this sudden, awakening of like, now EVs are again equal to like the price point and now what they were, and we can't afford and those kind of things. I feel from the affordability side, EVs have a very unique position, and I'll get to that. But in terms of like electrification and headwinds, there's definitely, I would say, less about headwinds and more about like the realization of how practical EVs could be and wouldn't be. There's definitely this push towards EVs with the turn of a switch. It's going to solve your greenhouse gas emissions and those kind of problems. But everybody's starting to realize it's not the only solution. It's not the solution alone. Buying an EV is not going to save the world. It's a lot more than that. So it definitely, and in a nutshell, I think cities and governments have realized it's the energy that needs to be saved and made renewable, and the whole sustainability angle has to be brought in there than where the tailpipe emissions is going. So that's one. The other one is also, as you mentioned, there is competition. There is all this competition about what industry is flourishing in one country versus the other market. So whatever, right? So it also, I think, depends on where countries and regions are in terms of promoting EVs and sustainable powertrains, whether it's hydrogen or EVs or whatever. And they seem to be like choosing one team rather than the other. and trying to see what works for them nationally or regionally in terms of economics. And that's where they're moving at. So it's hard to say where it's going to go. But in terms of EVs, one thing is for sure, it's definitely made into the normalcy of conversations. So it's having an EV is a very normal thing now. Everybody is very comfortable driving an EV. They understand it. There's still constraints in terms of the range, the use cases, the time it takes for charging. But I feel the whole transportation space, whether be it on the operator side or the user side, the gap is definitely far less than what it was. So, for example, in car sharing, although electrification has now is pretty much a buzzword for them, sustainability, car share providers are looking at electrification very critically. So they realize that it's going to pile up initial cost for them, but they're also trying to see proven statistics on how EVs are going to benefit them in terms of operations and what kind of rebates can they tap into and how long can they tap into those rebates. They're also looking at, is EV going to give us any benefit in terms of higher utilization? Would it help us get more members? Would drivers drive it because it's an EV or not an EV? You know, and they have some favors, some markets they don't. But I think in general, they realize that EVs are for long term. The one thing that is not working out is the fluctuation in the market, right? So because compared to the IC engine vehicle, EVs are still new. And this is where I'm coming back to what I was alluding to before. The industry in terms of automotive is trying to, they are also pressed by profits. And in my opinion, they are trying to push as much as they can in terms of like the margin utility, in terms of what they can charge and what they can price an EV at. And it's still in that premium segment. It's still seen as a status symbol. It's still seen as something novel and something new and something that you need. You know, you can't be sustainable if you don't spend extra bucks. I feel that's like a general theme that comes out of our day-to-day lives. If you want to do something sustainable, it has to be something good for the planet, has to be expensive. Why? I don't understand why, but that's how everybody perceives it. And if it is not, that yes. There's definitely like some kind of greenwashing going around there. So I think that's where the EVs are going. And you mentioned about Tesla, also AVs, but let's look at what offerings are being given in terms of EVs today versus what they were before. Now, I don't know about every market, but we know that you are not able to order a Tesla right from the website as easily as before. The reason why I say that is they're sitting on a lot of inventory, and that's what they're trying to push first before even taking new orders. And I'm like, is this not like following the same, you know, circle of what IC engine automotive industry was about? And then the second one is you by default have a lot of features. Like if you order an EV, you get a default like long range battery model, and you don't get the short range battery model anymore, yeah. Right? So I feel sometimes it's an overcompensation to what is happening. So just to maintain that price point, although things may have been cheaper now than before. So fleets are not able to tap into, you know, a cheaper version of EVs. Now, after 5 years, EVs could have been cheaper, but they're not, because all you can get is like the 600 kilometers range one. But maybe for a car share vehicle, you don't need that. You can always use a, you know, 250 to 300 kilometer one, because, you know, car share providers have been using that before, right? And that's pretty much work fine. So they don't need to pay extra. So they can save that amount, but they're not able to, because the asking price of an EV is still pretty much the same. And then the problem has happened, and you would know this in Europe too, in the residual values. So that's been so volatile that nobody wants to touch the used market, because it's unpredictable. It's something that's not able to support like a long-term kind of budgeting cycle. And in car sharing, one of my mentors from my previous companies always mentioned, you know, car rental, car sharing, know the business that you're in. And in car rental and car sharing business, basically in a business of selling, reselling cars.
Yes.
So when you have to budget the price at which you buy a car and the price at which you will sell a car after 5 years. And then that's the difference that you're trying to maximize and make profit out of. And if the residual value is like 50% of the one that you budgeted, now you have a bigger problem because you've not been budgeting that for your utilization, for your pricing, for car rental or car share and whatever. So that's basically what the EV's equation is. And that's, I totally get why car sharing providers would, you know, feel a little bit skeptical before going all committed into EVs. Because that's it's not working out the way a traditional automobile would work for them.
Yeah, it's not very plannable, right? It's not very reliable. But what you described are, I see a lot of, let's say, immaturity in the market, in the market developments. Let's say economies of scale are not yet there. This is also resale value, right? Has to do with the market being immature. Cost of parts, cost of damage and stuff is relatively higher. But these are all things that have to do with the, let's say, levels of economies of scale not yet being there as you would have it with ICE vehicles, right? So for me, this, a lot of that is a question of time. What's interesting is what I saw is that if you take this Gartner hype cycle, right? And I think we're definitely over the hype. And what is it? Valley of disillusionment or something? But at the end of the day, I think this is where we are now. And people and the decision makers that I talk to, EV is not fancy anymore. It's not acquired because it's an, I don't know, USP or perceived premium, but because it makes financial sense to do that. And we're step by step getting there. And I think a more rational attitude towards inflating EVs is also what we need and will also increase the, let's say, the demand towards the manufacturers and providers. And competition is getting tough. I mean, we feel a lot coming in from China, especially into Europe. There's huge pressure coming in. And the options for both consumers as well as businesses will rather get more than less in that point in time. Yes. But thank you for sharing your view there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
Yeah, EVs are definitely something that makes a lot of sense for car sharing. But the only point there being it's not as straightforward as it may be for an individual, right? So when you talk about it's totally commonality for an individual to go choose. And that's my view too. So it's something that people would not consider as special as it was before. Right?
Absolutely.
So EVs are, everybody has an EV.
Yes.
It's fine. Everybody knows it.
Yes.
And that's great for the industry.
Yes.
The good thing about car sharing is it doesn't necessarily need to rely on EVs. The model itself relies on people driving less. So whether EVs or not, it's definitely going to help the sustainable goal by all means. And in that sense, I think the EVs is, although that we need policies that help EVs be more affordable on the car sharing side of things, if they're not, car sharing is still doing its bit.
Yes, absolutely. And I think in this sense, car sharing has a strong bridge function into something new, right? For me, the question is not whether car sharing is here to stay, because car sharing is going to grow. It's just the forms of car sharing are also fluid, getting more and more fluid, getting into subscription services, et cetera, et cetera. I got one question, Venkatesh. It's kind of the closing question. And it's a little bit of a game that I play with all my interview partners. So if you think about putting us into a time capsule and I transport us to the year 2035, so 10 years from now. And from the position of 2035, we look down to the two of us in the year 2025, so the now. What advice would you give us in the here and now?
It's kind of like playing Inception or Interstellar and going into the...
If you want to have.
Sure. Yeah, it's fun. Thanks for that question. It's
taking a moment to reflect.
I would say I would look back into the 2025 self of state of shared mobility and what my mind state is. Not that it's in my mind, but I would say continue sticking around with shared mobility. So that would be the advice. If I could give myself some more like stacks on like how it's going to get real, the space needs the experts and the efforts to make this as normal as it can get. And shared mobility is going to get to a level that people, it's going to be mainstream. So hold on to it.
Yes, and I fully agree that this is the exciting part about it. This is going to get so normal that people won't even talk about it, because it will not, in a sense of that, it is going to be totally mainstream and people might not even recognize it being shared, because it's a kind of normal, right? Because why would you own an asset necessarily that you have then to maintain and take care about and that takes space and whatever, right?
It would be like if people drove their own car during this new era that we are imagining ourselves in. If people drove their car to work or something, it would be like people took a private jet to fly somewhere, right? So it still will be there. So we will still see it, where it would be like, oh, sure. So you're like so fancy that you could charter a car to go there and not follow what common knowledge is. Right. So I like that.
Yes, exactly. Venkatesh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you in this next conversation journey. So I found it fascinating to hear from you, to learn from you how strongly really regulatory bodies and cities actually also shape this ecosystem that we're in. Because from the technology side, sometimes things are simpler, but there was a great learning for me. So thank you very much for sharing that with me. I hope it was also interesting for the listeners and the audience. I wish the two of us also a very curious time in what's going to happen with shared mobility. We don't know it, but I think we have a glimpse into the future. Again, thank you very much for this conversation, and all the best.
This is all mine. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. Subscribe and tune in again next time.